From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, John Green, his popular young adult novel, The Fault in Our Stars, is about a relationship between two teenagers with cancer. His new novel is about a teenager with OCD, which Green has too.
I get afraid of having an illness or having some kind of contamination inside of my body, and then I become unable to stop thinking about that, and the worry begins to consume me.
Also, Matthew Walker tells us why so many of us are not getting enough sleep and warns that the less sleep you get, the more at risk you are for heart disease, diabetes, Alzheimer's, and more.
Short sleep predicts a shorter life.
Walker directs the Center for Human Sleep Science at the University of California, Berkeley. And John Powers reviews a debut short story collection by an author he describes as an extraordinary young writer. First News. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Green, has a huge following, mostly among teenagers who are fans of his young adult novels, like The Fault in Our Stars, which sold over 23 million copies, was on the bestseller list for 24 weeks, and was adapted into a film. Green and his brother Hank also have a popular video blog called Vlog Brothers. His young adult novels wrestle with the kind of issues you'd expect from someone like Green, who had considered joining the seminary and worked as a student chaplain at a children's hospital. The Fault in Our Stars is about two teenagers with cancer who fall in love. His new novel, Turtles All the Way Down, is about a 16-year-old girl named Aza, who's grieving the death of her father while also dealing with OCD, obsessive-compulsive disorder, which leads to intrusive thoughts that get in the way of her day-to-day life, interfere with her relationship with her best friend, and with her ability to have a boyfriend. Her obsession is with all the microorganisms that live on and in her body, and her fear that she will become infected with a deadly bacteria. John Green drew on his own experiences with OCD, which he's dealt with since childhood. John Green, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like you to start by reading from your new book, but first, since her obsession is fear of getting C. difficile, a.k.a. C. diff. Why don't you describe what this really horrendous disease is?
Sure. C. diff is a disease that is usually associated with antibiotic use in hospitals. And it basically, there's this bacteria in your gut. And if it grows out of control, you can become very, very sick. And this is something that Aza worries about all the time. And she uses kind of compulsive behaviors, including checking the internet for symptoms to try to manage this worry that she has.
And just to get a little bit more graphic, I mean, C. diff leads to really extreme diarrhea. And in some people, particularly in elderly people, you can die if it's not treated. So it's a very serious and a very problematic infection. And you're also going to refer in the reading I'm about to ask you to do to the microbiome, which is the collection of bacteria and microorganisms in the gut. And so the goal is to always have a healthy microbiome.
Yeah, I mean, one of the really weird things about being a person is that about half of the cells inside of your body are not yours. They're microbes. And that's also something that is of some concern to Aza, and for that matter, to me.
Oh, I know. It's a remarkable thing when you think about how your whole body, your skin, your gut, everything is just like populated with these microorganisms, which is scientifically fascinating. But the more you think about it, the kind of creepier it is. And for her, it's more than creepy. It's disturbing. It's very deeply disturbing. So I want you to do a reading. And this is from like a little more than midway through the book. And she has been friends with and is kind of starting to become girlfriend-boyfriend with a teenage boy. They're starting to kiss a little bit, and because of this whole microbiome thing, it's making her really uncomfortable. And some of what we're going to be hearing is her intrusive OCD, her obsessive compulsive thoughts, interfering with the rest of her thoughts. So some of what you're saying is written in italics, and all the italicized parts are those intrusive thoughts interfering in her mind. Okay. Would you do the reading?
I told myself to be in this moment, to let myself feel his warmth on my skin, but now his tongue was on my neck, wet and alive and microbial, and his hand was sneaking under my jacket, his cold fingers against my bare skin. It's fine, you're fine, just kiss him. You need to check something. It's fine, just be normal. Check to see if his microbes stay in you. Billions of people kiss and don't die. Just make sure his microbes aren't going to permanently colonize you. Come on, please, stop this. He could have Campylobacter. He could have non-symptomatic E. coli that you could get, and then you'll need antibiotics, and then you'll get C. diff, and boom, dead in 4 days. Please, just stop. Just check. Make sure. I pulled away. You okay? He asked. I nodded. I just need a little air. I sat up, turned away from him, pulled out my phone, and searched, do bacteria of people you kiss stay inside your body? And quickly scrolled through a couple pseudoscience results before getting to the one actual study done on the subject. Around 80 million microbes are exchanged on average per kiss, and quote, after 6 month follow-up, human gut microbiomes appear to be modestly but consistently altered. His bacteria would be in me forever. 80 million of them, breeding and growing and joining my bacteria and producing God knows what. I felt his hand on my shoulder. I spun around and squirmed away from him, my breath running away from me, dots in my vision. You're fine. He's not even the first boy you've kissed. 80 million organisms in you forever. Calm down. Permanently altering the microbiome. This is not rational. You need to do something. Please, there is a fix. Please get to a bathroom. What's wrong? He asked. Nothing, I said. I just need to use the restroom. I pulled my phone back out to reread the study, but resisted the urge, clicked it shut, and slid it back into my pocket. But no, I had to check to see if it had said modestly altered or moderately altered. I pulled out my phone again and brought up the study. Modestly. Okay. Modestly is better than moderately. But consistently. I felt nauseated and disgusting, but also pathetic. I knew how I looked to him. I knew that my crazy was no longer a quirk. Now it was an irritation. Like it was to anyone who got close to me.
Thank you for reading that. That's John Green reading from his new novel, which is called Turtles All the Way Down. So of all the obsessive compulsive thoughts you could have given your main character, Asa, why did you give her this obsession with C. diff?
Well, partly because I can relate to it. I mean, I needed a place where I could make a connection with Asa in order to write about her, I think. And I've long had a fear of contamination from microorganisms. That's long been one of the kind of focuses of my particular version of obsessive compulsive disorder. And so I think that was partly it, but also it's something that we live with all the time. It's something that surrounds us, you know, like in a way, bacteria are overwhelming us. We are the dominant species on the planet, until and unless you start considering bacteria.
So one of the things that she has are these thought spirals. I'm going to ask you to describe a thought spiral.
Well, the thing about a spiral is that if you follow it inward, it just keeps going forever. It just gets tighter and tighter, and it never actually ends. And that's kind of how Asa experiences her thoughts when she gets stuck into this kind of looping, turning, twisting series of thoughts about how she's definitely going to get C. diff and she's definitely going to die. And then she has to use these behaviors that she's developed to try to manage that fear. And there really is no way for her to pull out of the thought spiral. And that's part of what makes it so frightening to her, is that once she's in it, it doesn't feel like a thought spiral. It just feels like thought. It just feels like the way of the world. It feels like she's not wrong when she's afraid of this this infection or the other things that she fears. And that's really terrifying. It's also really isolating for her because she struggles to be able to describe it with language. She struggles for the words that that would help other people understand what she's going through.
She uses the word invasives to describe the kind of thoughts that you can't control and that take over. Is that your word, or did you get that from therapy?
I think it's my word. When I was first told about OCD, I was told that these thoughts are called intrusives, but I actually heard the word invasives for some reason, and that is what it's like for me. It's like there's an invasive weed that just spreads out of control. You know, it starts out with one little thought, and then slowly that becomes the only thought that you're able to have, the thought that you're constantly either forced to have or trying desperately to distract yourself from.
You sprinkle quotes from great writers throughout the book, and the opening quote is from the philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer. And the quote is, "Man can do what he wills, but he cannot will what he wills." Why has that such resonance for you?
I mean, that's my experience of being a person. Like, it's not so much the problem of free will, it's the problem of not being able to define my will. I mean, one of the things that Asa finds so scary in the book, and one of the things that I also have struggled with, is if these thoughts feel like they're coming from outside of me and I'm forced to have them and I can't choose my thoughts, then who exactly am I? You know, like, who's running the ship here? Am I really the captain of my consciousness, or is there some outside force that's shaping this for me? And so I'm not that interested in the question of free will, but I'm really, really interested in the question of how I experience some level of sovereignty over myself, I guess.
So at what point did you decide that you would write a novel with a main character who has, as you do, obsessive compulsive disorder?
In some ways, the choice was made for me because I couldn't write about anything else. I tried to write a few other novels after The Fault in Our Stars came out, and I ended up having to abandon them. And then eventually, I got really sick, and coming out of that period of being really
OCD sick?
Yeah, yeah. I just had a really poor period of mental health where for a few months, I wasn't able to feel like I was in any control over what I was thinking about, and coming out of that period, this was kind of the only thing that I felt like I could write about, and so that became the story that I ended up writing.
So you've said that you have OCD. Tell us more about what form it has taken in your life.
Well, I guess the sort of dominant form that it's taken in my life is that I get worried, I get afraid of having an illness or having some kind of contamination inside of my body, and then I become unable to stop thinking about that, and the worry begins to consume me. And you know, in the face of that, you develop, or I have developed, compulsive behaviors to try to manage that and deal with that. But for me, it starts, there's a reason the O comes first in OCD. Like, in the popular imagination, we always see people doing their compulsive behaviors because they're so visual and they're so often so strange and eccentric. But for me, it's the problem of my thoughts that is the problem. The compulsive behaviors are a way of trying to manage the kind of overwhelming fear that the obsessiveness causes me.
So what are the things you're most afraid of contaminating you?
I mean, there's I'm being super intentional about not saying that.
Oh, okay.
That's
fine.
Yeah, that's the only thing that I can't talk directly about it because I get squirmy.
You get what? Squirmy?
Yeah.
Would it be awkward too for us all to know, like, say we met you in person sometime? Would it be awkward for you to have everybody know what that most vulnerable point was?
Yes.
Yeah, understandable.
Yeah, that's why.
Yeah. So in the novel, there's a physical manifestation as well as obsessive compulsive thoughts. The physical manifestation has to deal with digging the fingernail of one finger into the finger pad of another. Have you had a physical manifestation like that too?
Yeah, not exactly that, but I count on my fingers as a way of calming myself, and so I think that's probably why I started thinking about it. And then I like the idea that, you know, it's literally affecting her fingerprint. You know, it's affecting who she is in a pretty profound way.
For Asa, your main character, the OCD leads to a form of self-obsession, which makes her self-absorbed and not tuned into other people. And her best friend calls her out for it. Her best friend basically says, "You probably don't even, you know, she lists things that she assumes Asa doesn't even know about her because she's so absorbed with herself. Was there a point in your life where you felt that your OCD was actually making you self-absorbed in a way that you didn't want to be, that you were neglecting other people, that you were losing a sense of empathy because you were looking within so much?
It has definitely affected my real-life relationships over the years in profound ways. I also wanted Asa to struggle with her ability to observe the world outside of herself because I think that is true to my experience, and it is not true to the kind of narrative of the obsessive detective that we have in the popular imagination. Obsessiveness is often linked to this like genius of observation that just is not my experience at all. Like I find that my OCD makes me a terrible detective.
Because you're focused on the wrong thing, obsessively.
Yeah, because I can't notice the world outside of myself in the way that I want to, because I'm so deeply and irrationally focused on stuff that's happening kind of within me.
My guest is John Green, author of the young adult novel The Fault in Our Stars and a new one called Turtles All the Way Down. After we take a short break, we'll talk about what it was like when he fell in love for the first time. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, offering a way to buy home insurance with their Home Quote Explorer tool. Custom quotes and rates are available online. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive. And from Inada, creators of the Japanese-made DreamWave massage chair with shiatsu point detection and 16 programmed massages, including morning and nighttime sessions. Retail dealers nationwide. More at dreamwavechair.com.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Green, who's famous for his young adult novels, including The Fault in Our Stars, which was about two teenagers with cancer who fall in love. His new novel, Turtles All the Way Down, is about a 16-year-old girl who's still recovering from the death of her father and is afraid to have a relationship with a boy because of her OCD. Her obsession is with her microbiome, all the bacteria and other microorganisms on and in her body. She lives in fear that she will get the intestinal infection C. diff, which can be life-threatening. Are you surprised that so many teenagers want to read stories about teenagers who have the kind of problems that make you feel different from everyone else, like OCD, or like having lost a parent who died, or like having cancer and maybe dying yourself? I mean, so many teenagers are just absorbed with, you know, school, finding a new boyfriend or girlfriend, just like having friends, figuring out how to make your way without being bullied or hated by other kids. But I mean, you're dealing with really major problems in your book. Not to make light of those other problems, because when you're a teenager, those other problems are really big.
Right. No, I think that's actually the answer, though, is that when you're a teenager, no matter what your experience is, the problems are big, and they're in many cases new. In many cases, it's the first time you've had this problem. So, you know, when I fell in love with my wife, you know, we have a great, awesome marriage, but I was also like, this is like the other times I fell in love. Like, I understood what was happening to me. But when I fell in love for the first time, I was like, what is this completely unprecedented thing that has never existed in human history before? And so I think there's, that intensity to the firstness of all these experiences that teenagers are going through, I think is part of what makes them connect to people who feel who are going through really unusual experiences.
Do you remember your first girlfriend, your first crush, and can you tell us about it, or would you rather not?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, my first crush was in third grade, and I wore, like, matching OP shorts and a shirt to ask her to go with me, which was the parlance of the day. And I remember, like, just feeling so incredibly nervous, as if the stakes were actually high and I wasn't 9 years old, and asking her to go with me. And she said yes. And I was like, this is incredible. But then I had no idea, like, what the next step was. You know, like, I had no idea, like, how do we proceed from here? So we eventually exchanged phone numbers and had a few phone conversations over the next few weeks. And then I don't think there was ever an official breakup. I think it just was sort of understood that this wasn't going to end in marriage.
Did you tell your parents?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I definitely told my parents. I was like, I have a girlfriend. And they were like, why?
Did you kiss?
No. I don't even think we held hands, actually.
So what did it mean to have a girlfriend?
Nothing. I mean, yeah, I think it must have been born from the stories I was reading. Like, I was really into, like, series books like Sweet Valley High and The Babysitter's Club. And so it must have come from those stories that, like, this is what you do. And I was like, all right, I'll give it a try.
Do you remember the first time you fell in love for real?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was in college.
Did the OCD get in the way of that?
It got in the way of it in the sense that it's really difficult, I think, for anyone who is close to someone who's in terrible psychic pain to be near that pain for a lot of reasons. One, you want to take it away. Two, it's just difficult. And so it was a problem, especially, we dated for a few years, and I think it was a problem, especially at the end of our relationship, because I would lose a lot of myself, my ability to pay attention to the world outside of myself, to these thought spirals, and I wouldn't be able to pull myself out of it enough to be a good partner or to be a good friend even. And that was definitely a problem.
I want to quote something that Asa, your teenage character, says in the book, or thinks in the book. I hated my body. It disgusted me. Its hair, its pinpricks of sweat, its scrawniness, skin pulled over a skeleton, an animated corpse. I wanted out of my body, out of my thoughts, out. But I was stuck inside of this thing, like all of the bacteria colonizing me. Is this a feeling you understand of, like, hating your body and feeling kind of disgusted by it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for much of my life, I felt like I had to carry around this skin-encased bacterial colony in order to have a mind and a consciousness, you know? And also, I've often felt like my body is trying to control my consciousness or dictating what I can think about or what I can feel. And that feels really frustrating. I have to say that in the last few years, I've come around to the body a little bit, partly through exercise, partly through cognitive behavioral therapy techniques. And I don't see my body anymore as the opposite of me. But I do still feel at times frustrated by the fact that I'm stuck inside of just this one vessel, you know? So I don't know. I'm very grateful for my body now. But at the same time, I do rather wish that, you know, like, it could go on forever and never hurt.
Sure, and there's times you probably want to trade in your brain also, right?
Absolutely, yeah. No, I mean, there's probably more times when I want to trade
thoughts
in my brain.
yeah,
to be completely honest, like, it'd be great to be able to, like, turn my brain into the mechanic and, like, have them just, like, fix some stuff up and then give it back to me. That would be great.
So I read that you said you were bullied when you were in, I don't know, junior high or high school. Anything in particular you were bullied for, you know, that you were mocked for?
I mean, I don't really know. They don't seem to need a great reason.
They don't tell you as they're reading you up?
Right, yeah. That would have been nice, though, if they could have, like, sent a note that just explained, like, here are the three things you're being bullied for. And if you could work on these three things, then we'll stop. I think I was different. I was very nerdy. I struggled socially, partly because I was really stuck inside of myself. And I think I was at times kind of an annoying kid because I was a little obsessive and perpetually nervous. But none of that justifies the bullying that that happened. It was, yeah, it was difficult. And the middle school years especially were extremely difficult for me. And I did have friends, and I was very grateful for those friends, but the bullying was scary and difficult.
Did you fight back?
No. This is going to surprise you, Terry, but I'm not not really super able to fight back.
I never would have expected that.
Yeah, I'm not a boxer.
And when did you realize you wanted to write?
Well, I always liked writing, but I thought of it like being an astronaut or being a professional athlete or something. I never thought of it as a realistic career goal. And in some ways, I still have a day job, and I like having a day job. I like going into the office in the afternoon and working on the online video stuff that we make. But after I decided not to go to divinity school, I started working at this magazine called Booklist. I was a assistant there, mostly doing data entry. But Booklist reviews like 400 books every 2 weeks. And, you know, all those books were written by somebody. And so that's when I started to feel...
But were they
like,
read
well,
by
maybe...
anybody is the question.
not all of them, certainly. But that's when I started to feel like, okay, well, it's not quite like being a professional athlete or being an astronaut. Like, this is something that regular people do. Lots of people write books. And that's when I started to feel like maybe I could write a book. And at the same time, I started reading a lot of young adult books, and I really loved them. And I thought, well, that would be a great place. Like, that would be such a cool place to publish. And so when I was writing my first novel, I was kind of hoping that, that's where it would end up, and it did.
Why were you starting to read a lot of young adult books then?
I think partly because I was the youngest person at Booklist, so I was the closest thing they had to a young adult.
They asked you to read the young adult books.
Yeah.
So you were reviewing young adult fiction and then decided you wanted to write it too.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Why did that seem like a good fit?
Well, I mean, there are a bunch of reasons, I think. I like the way that young adult books are published. I like that science fiction and mystery and romance all live on the shelf together. The genre separations that you see in books for grown-ups aren't there in the same way. Also, YA books tend to hang around because of support from librarians and teachers, and that was really appealing to me. But in terms of character and readers, you know, it's a privilege to have a seat at the table in somebody's life when they're forming their values, and that's, for me, what my experience was as a teen reader, and you know, I hope that my books can be part of that conversation for teen readers today.
John Green, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
John Green's new young adult novel is called Turtles All the Way Down. Our critic at large, John Powers, has a review of a new book he says wowed him right from the start. It's called Her Body and Other Parties. It's the first collection of short stories by Carmen Maria Machado. The book was recently named one of the 5 finalists for the National Book Award in Fiction.
Whenever I open a new work of fiction, I'm not looking for the stuff that we critics talk about. You know, a dazzling prose style or a big important theme. What I want most is to be grabbed by a fresh and compelling way of seeing the world. To encounter a voice that makes me think, I can't wait to spend my day with this person. That happened to me with Her Body and Other Parties, a first collection of stories by Carmen Maria Machado, an extraordinary young writer about whom I know very little. I know she's 31. I know she lives with her wife in Philadelphia. And I know she's a true original. Cross-pollinating fairy tales, horror movies, TV shows, and a terrific sense of humor. Her work reminds me at different times of such wildly divergent figures as David Lynch, Jane Campion, Maggie Nelson, and Grace Paley. Which is a way of saying Machado sounds like nobody but herself. The 8 stories here are all about women in extremis, physical danger, psychological meltdown, treacherous love, or close encounters of a ghostly kind. In the one called 8 Bites, an overweight woman has stomach reduction surgery, only to discover you can never really get rid of your weight. In Difficult at Parties, a young assault victim tries to re-enter the world of human touch by watching pornography. but keeps hearing the wretched internal monologues of the performers. Steeped in pop storytelling, Machado likes to start off matter-of-factly, then open a trapdoor beneath your expectations. She does that brilliantly in the opening story, The Husband Stitch, which is destined to be anthologized for decades. It begins with something happily down to earth, a 17-year-old girl coming onto a guy she finds attractive. But as she tells the story of her life, she also tells us scads of other stories about dead brides, murdered couples, unhappy mothers, until her own life becomes a kind of terrifying fairy tale. Stories can sense happiness, she tells us, and snuff it out like a candle. Now, Machado is not one of those icy writers, Angela Carter comes to mind, whose stories deconstruct fairy tales or make their subtext explicit. Rather, like Emil Ferris in her great graphic novel, My Favorite Thing is Monsters, Machado loves horror stories for their visceral power, their way of calling up our fears. She taps into this hot psychic juice to make us feel the many ways that society tries to tame or erase women, and the ways they do it to themselves. She pays special attention to the female body, a keystone of feminist thinking ever since the groundbreaking 1971 bestseller, Our Bodies, Ourselves. Every page is charged with a sense of physicality, be it the rush of two lovers kissing, the bloody scalpel cuts of childbirth, or the way that a girl, who has literally begun to vanish, has skin that looks, in a vivid image, more like skim milk than whole. As you might expect, there's a lot of sex in her body and other parties, and Machado writes well about its thrills and its dangers. Even as she gives free rein to the pleasures of the flesh, she knows that the very thing that gives a woman carnal pleasure may be risky for the rest of her. Whether she's chronicling the eerie secret of a shopping mall dress shop, or riffing on the psychosexual underpinnings of Law & Order SVU, Machado's vision is obviously feminist and unabashedly queer. Yet she's far too talented a storyteller to grind axes or to reduce her work to neat doctrinaire lessons. After all, our bodies aren't doctrinaire. They are what they are, and they want what they want. Women, men, both, no one. Often independently of our minds. Near the end of the book, a writer who resembles Machado reads her work to a group of artists. One of her listeners, a female poet-composer, accuses her of simply recycling the old tropes of the mad woman in the attic and the angry lesbian. I suspect this probably happened to Machado along the way. Yet reading this imaginative and enjoyable collection, which charts dark territory with enormous style, wit, and storytelling panache, you wonder how any listener could possibly feel that way.
John Powers writes about film and TV for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed Her Body and Other Parties by Carmen Maria Machado. Coming up, Matthew Walker, author of Why We Sleep, tells us what's going on in the brain when we sleep and gives us some advice on how to get a better night's sleep. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Rhodes Scholar, a nonprofit educational travel institution providing learning adventures for adults, families, grandparents, and grandchildren. Information is available at roadscholar.org/grandparent. And from the Candida Fund, supporting individual dignity and sustainable communities through investments in transformative leaders and ideas. Learn more at kendedafund.org. Thank you.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest wants you to get more sleep, and he has some warnings about how not getting enough sleep can affect your concentration, memory, immune system, blood sugar levels, appetite, and more. On the bright side, he has some suggestions to help you get and stay asleep. Matthew Walker directs the Center for Human Sleep Science at the University of California, Berkeley, where he's a professor of neuroscience and psychology. In his sleep lab, he's conducted many sleep studies using the latest techniques to image the brain and monitor brain activity in order to investigate why we sleep and what happens when we sleep and when we dream. He's currently investigating the possible link between inadequate sleep and the development of Alzheimer's disease. He's written a new book called Why We Sleep. Matthew Walker, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you here. So something unusual happened. I usually wake up like once or twice in the middle of the night. I've done that all my life. I've never understood how people can actually lie down and then just wake up the next morning without even having moved all night. But I slept till 5:30, which was kind of shocking. And then I had a great deal of difficulty falling back to sleep because my alarm was set for 6:50. So on the one hand, I slept really well. And on the other hand, I didn't. Like before 5:30, great. After 5:30, not great. So how did you tell me, how did I sleep last night?
So it depends on how long you were staying awake after that 5:30 morning awakening. And the advice usually, by the way, is this, that you should not actually stay in bed for very long awake, because your brain is this remarkably associative device and it quickly learns that the bed is about being awake. So you should go to another room, a room that's dim, just read a book, no screens, no phones. And only when you're sleepy, return to the bed. And that way your brain relearns the association with your bedroom being about sleep rather than wakefulness.
How many hours of sleep should I be getting?
The recommendation by the World Health Organization is 8 hours. And most people don't put their head on the pillow and instantly fall asleep. It's not like a light switch. Falling asleep is like landing a plane. It takes time. You've got to sort of gradually descend. I think one of the problems with insufficient sleep is people are not very good at predicting how poorly they are doing when they are underslept. So your subjective sense of how well you're doing is a miserable predictor of objectively how you're doing. So it's a little bit like the drunk driver at a bar. They've had a couple of shots and some beer, and they stand up and they say, well, I'm perfectly fine to drive home. And you say, no, I know that you think you're fine to drive, but trust me, objectively, you're not. And the same is true for sleep. So I think many people walk through their lives in an underslept state, not realizing it. It's become this new natural baseline.
Yeah, but most people don't have 8 hours available to sleep. So if you're sleeping, say, 6.5 to 7 hours, as I think a lot of adults do, how much are you depriving yourself of? I mean, what are you losing? What are your deficits because you're not sleeping enough?
Well, I think the first general point to make from epidemiological studies across millions of people is that short sleep predicts a shorter life. It predicts all-cause mortality. So that sort of classic maxim that you may have heard, that you can sleep when you're dead, it is actually mortally unwise advice from a very serious standpoint. We also know that every disease that is killing us in developed nations has causal and significant links to a lack of sleep, and a lack of sleep defined as 6 hours of sleep or less. So I think people really need to start to become much more aware of the science of sleep. And I think that in part is why people like me have failed. We've not done a good job at communicating the science and the impact of insufficient sleep to the public.
So I cheat on sleep during the week and only get like 6.5 to 7 hours. But on the weekend, I'll try to sleep like 8 hours sometimes. Mm. Sometimes I'm in bed for 9 hours, which is like, I think, amazing. So am I making up for the deficits of the week?
So you're trying to sleep off a debt that you've lumbered your brain and body with during the week. And wouldn't it be lovely if sleep worked like that? Sadly, it doesn't. Sleep is not like the bank. So you can't accumulate a debt and then try and pay it off at a later point in time. And the reason is this. We know that if I were to deprive you of sleep for an entire night, take away 8 hours, and then in the subsequent nights, I give you all of the sleep that you want, however much you wish to consume, you never get back all that you lost. So the brain has no capacity to get back that lost sleep.
So one of the reasons why you keep telling us we need to be sleeping more, we need to be sleeping 8 hours a night, is that sleep helps us remember things. It's good for memory, but it also helps us forget the things that we would just as soon forget. So what goes on in our brain in terms of memory and forgetting as we sleep?
Sleep seems to provide a form of forgetting in at least two ways. One is that if information does not seem to be relevant, or even if it's duplicate information, sleep will enhance that which is necessary and important to remember, and it will actually let go of that which doesn't seem to be important to you, the organism, based on a variety of reasons. So sleep can actually not only supply you and facilitate the things that are essential to hold on to, but it will actually clear up storage space, as it were, by removing things that are unnecessary and not wanted, so that you don't get clutter. It's like having a wonderful sort of clean desk, a great filing system where only the things that you need are put in place and they're not sullied by all of the noise surrounding it. There's a very clear signal-to-noise ratio when it comes to information within the brain by way of sleep.
Is the brain too busy while we're awake to do the things that it does while we're sleeping?
The brain is certainly caught up with a vast variety of different aspects during waking consciousness. And I think the principal goal when it comes to learning and memory for wakefulness is information reception. We're constantly acquiring, downloading, aggregating that information. In contrast, I think sleep is all about reflection. So rather than it being a state where we're receiving information, it's going back over that information and asking, on the basis of what we learned today, what's novel and new? What do we need to hold on to? What do we need to forget? And how does this new information fit with this vast back catalog of autobiographical information that we have? And how should all of that be stitched together so that when I wake up the next day, I have this improved, accurate statistical model of this thing called the world and how it works, so that my survival chances each and every day get better by sleep each and every night?
You have people in your sleep lab and you're imaging their brains as they sleep. When you're doing imaging while somebody's sleeping, are you able to tell when they're dreaming? And are there times when the person thinks that they haven't had any dreams, but you know that they actually have?
Yes, on both counts. So we can be sitting in a control room many, many feet away from the individual, and just based on these beautiful brain waves that we can be seeing, we will know with high accuracy not only whether they're awake or asleep, and if they're asleep, what stage of sleep that they're in. We will also be able to predict whether they're dreaming. There is a phase of rapid eye movement sleep that gives it its name, where you're actually getting these darting eye movements that go back and forth, left and right, left and right. And if I wake you up as you're having REM sleep, dream sleep, with a phase of these rapid eye movement darts occurring, it's 95 to 100% probable that you're going to report a dream when I wake you up. And there are those people who say, I just never dream. I'm just not one of those people who actually dreams. And the answer, of course, is that you're simply not one of those people who remembers their dreams. Almost everyone dreams. There's a rare type of brain damage that can occur where people seem not to dream, although even that is questionable.
So one of the areas you've been researching is the correlation between sleep or lack of sleep and Alzheimer's disease. So what have you learned? Is there a correlation that you're finding?
There's a strong relationship now between insufficient sleep and the mechanisms of Alzheimer's disease. Sadly, it's a two-way street as well that we've discovered. There was a remarkable finding several years ago that revealed the brain actually has a sewage system inside of it. And our body actually has one. It's called the lymphatic system that many people have heard of. But only recently did we discover that the brain has one. It's called the glymphatic system. And one of the things that that sewage system in the brain does very well is clear out all of the detritus that's been building up, all of the metabolic waste that's been building up throughout the day. The second discovery, though, is that the sewage system in the brain actually kicks into high gear when we go into sleep, and particularly deep sleep. And one of the toxic byproducts that it actually removes at night is a sticky protein called beta amyloid, which is one of the leading causes that we believe underlying Alzheimer's disease. So firstly, we start to understand now why short sleep seems to predict a far higher risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. And it does. That data now from epidemiological studies is there, and I think it's quite clear. But now we're starting to understand exactly why insufficient sleep is one of the most significant lifestyle factors determining whether or not you will develop Alzheimer's disease. The two-way street, sadly, is that if that toxic sticky protein, beta amyloid, builds up in the brain, it doesn't simply build up everywhere in the brain constantly. It seems to build up in some regions more quickly and more severely than others. And sadly, the regions that it targets very early on and aggressively are the deep sleep generating regions. So you produce this vicious cycle. If you're not getting enough sleep throughout your life, more of this protein seems to build up in the brain. The more of that protein that builds up, the harder it is to actually get that deep quality of sleep that you need whenever you do get the chance to get sleep. So the less of that toxic protein you're able to wash away at night, the more of that toxic protein that builds up, the harder it is to fall asleep, so on and so forth. It's this ongoing self-fulfilling prophecy.
Have you followed up with people who do have Alzheimer's and investigated whether they were good sleepers or not, and whether that correlation seems to bear out in people who already have Alzheimer's?
That's exactly what we're doing right now. We've been fortunate to receive grant funding to actually really dig down and do a deep dive into this issue. We are doing retrospective analyses to try and see if we can understand how people were sleeping in midlife to see if that is a deterministic factor. We are also starting to explore the sleep of patients who have quite severe pathology in their brain, quite severe stages of Alzheimer's disease within the brain. We already know that patients with Alzheimer's disease have remarkably bad sleep. It's far worse than even someone of their same age counterpart, but who does not have Alzheimer's disease. We know that as sleep gets worse in Alzheimer's patients, it walks and strides in lockstep with the decline cognitively of those Alzheimer's patients too. So those two things seem to go hand in hand, and perhaps one perhaps is causing the other, and we're going to try and understand that too. I think one of the other aspects, though, to give perhaps a little glimmer of hope, is that we're starting to try and explore therapeutic avenues. If sleep is causally instrumental, if sleep is a missing piece in the explanatory puzzle of aging and Alzheimer's, it's exciting because we may be able to do something about it. And here we're not talking about sleeping pills just because they don't produce that good, healthy sleep. We're actually starting to develop brain stimulation technology where we're actually trying to sing in time with these deficient deep sleep brain waves, almost like acting as if we were a choir to a flagging lead vocalist. And we're trying to amplify the size of those deep sleep brainwaves. And in doing so, we're going to try and salvage aspects of learning and memory function that depend on that deep sleep. And if that works, maybe we can actually shift that treatment benefit from an end-stage model of therapy, of treatment, to a midlife intervention, which is actually prevention rather than treatment. So it's a lofty goal. It's one of my moonshots, and I'm sure we will likely fail, but we are definitely going to try. We have to try.
I certainly hope you have success with that research. I'd like to ask you to sum up for us some of the things we can do to improve the quantity and quality of our sleep. Stay away from screens. We all know we're supposed to do that, whether we do it or not. What else can we be doing to make sure that we fall asleep and stay asleep?
You've hit on one of, I think, five tips for getting better sleep right now. The first is dark. We are a dark-deprived society, so stay away from those screens and laptops, as you've said. But also dim the lights down in the evening. We don't need all of the lights blazing in the last hour or so before bed. That will help. And blackout curtains can be of use, too. The four other tips would be this: regularity. If there is one piece of advice that folks should follow for better sleep, it is this: go to bed at the same time, wake up at the same time, no matter whether it's the weekday, the weekend, whether you've had a good night of sleep or bad night of sleep. The second is temperature, and keep it cool at night, cooler than you think, probably around 65 to 68 degrees, which I know sounds too cold. But your body needs to drop its temperature to initiate sleep. And it's the reason it's always easier to fall asleep in a room that's too cold than too hot. So keeping it cool moves your body in the right direction for good sleep. The other thing, don't stay in bed if you've been awake, because your brain learns the connection between wakefulness and your bed. So get out, go to a different room. The final aspect, no caffeine or alcohol. It will really do you a remarkable disservice by loading with caffeine sometime after 2 p.m. or having that nightcap in the evening. Both should be avoided if you wish for good sleep.
Okay, I think I'll go to sleep. Thank you so much for talking with us.
You're so very welcome.
Matthew Walker is the author of the new book, Why We Sleep, and the director of the Center for Human Sleep Science at the University of California, Berkeley. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Schirach, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Teresa Madden, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Home Advisor, matching homeowners with background-checked professionals for a variety of home projects, from minor repairs to major remodels. Homeowners can read reviews, compare prices, and book appointments online at homeadvisor.com. And from Progressive Insurance, offering its Home Quote Explorer, so shoppers can evaluate options in one place when buying home insurance. Custom quotes and rates are available online. Learn more at progressive.com.